Okay, welcome once again to another Throttle Up Radio show and podcast, and I'm your host, Captain Kevin Smith, and I am glad to be here. We had a couple of weeks off, but we're back now, and this is great. Producing another radio show and podcast, I should say that the radio show is found in Red State Talk Radio, correct? I'm talking to my audio engineer, Red State Talk Radio, weekends, on Saturdays and Sundays, both channels, right? So, pretty good presence there. And also, it's a podcast available on all podcast platforms that we are aware of. Again, the name of the show is Throttle Up, Throttle Up Radio. Also, we have a website, throttleupradio.com. I guess that's one word, isn't it, for the website? Throttleupradio.com is one word. And so it's got all of our shows archived there as well. What am I using right now? CastBox. I'm using that as a platform for the podcast. Podbean is another one. iTunes is the third one. Apple Play is the fourth one. And there's a bunch more. In our website, yes. Yes, of course. Yeah. You can download it from our website or play it on our website, which is throttleupradio.com. Okay, so there we go. Today's show, well, we have a long-running series. We're doing Think Like a Fighter Pilot. Reasons are obvious. We have got to improve the way we think across the board as a individual and as a member of society, as a culture. Member of whatever organization we are attached to, there's a lot of things that are insulting our intellect, and so we need to be able to think in ways that are kind of hardened against information warfare. Basically, if you want to be, to be blunt about it, we've just got to get better. Okay, better at what? Better at thinking. Thinking and reasoning. I use those two terms together, and they mean roughly the same thing, a little bit different, but I think the meaning is pretty obvious. And so, that's what we're doing. Today's show is called The Entry Protocol. Why are we doing this show? Well, I have a great question. My audio engineer will be reading this start of this show, presenting me with another question that I will attempt to answer. All right, so here goes, and here's my great audio engineer with this week's question.
Hi, Kevin, and hello to your listeners. Okay, you, in a recent Substack article or posting, you mentioned the entry protocol. So, would you tell everyone what is the entry protocol and why is it important?
Okay, so yes, another great question. Entry protocol. What exactly are we talking about? What we're talking about is both comes from both the military arena and the commercial arena. So let me define it a little bit clearer. All right. The entry protocol means that you have entered either the battle space or the problem space. The battle space is a military term. All right. So this is we are engaged in a military operation, and so we use the term battle space. If we are not, if we're dealing with a commercial operation, then we call it the problem space, and they both have similarities. They both are largely the same, although the battle space is more lethal, but the problem space could contain some serious risks to the enterprise, to the organization, to the company, and what have you. If it is, in fact, seagoing or airborne-related company operation, then it could be quite lethal. There are dangers out there where accidents and loss of life could very well occur. So there is a fair amount of similarities between the two. Okay, so we have the battle space or the problem space. Okay, we will encounter either the battle space or the problem space many times in the course of our lives, or I could say many times during the course of our professional life. We will enter, or we will prepare ourselves to enter, the battle space or the problem space. Okay. In my career, I entered both. Sometimes the battle space presented a serious problem that we had to deal with. And so we could say that the battle space and the problem space were superimposed upon one another, and that is certainly possible. It was, in fact, possible in my time, in my life, in my experience. In fact, it happened many, many times. Okay, so why do we want to first think about or first describe or at least conceptualize a space? Well, it's helpful. Okay, all right. The space could be a field of play. Okay, it could be a baseball diamond, it could be a football field, it could be a soccer field, ice rink for hockey, and the list goes on and on for almost forever. I think you get my point here, which is it's useful to think of it as a space. In the world of aerial combat, and particularly when we consider such things as the Top Gun Maverick movie, I think everybody out there has seen it more than at least once, very possibly more than once. I know that I have seen it a number of times. I don't remember how many times. I think I've seen it 5 times already. And I will continue to see it again because it's quite a remarkable film, and it gets to the heart of what I was involved with as well. Okay, so we are going to, first of all, we're going to address ourselves to what we call the battle space. Okay, and then we'll move on to the commercial side of the equation, but for the military side, we'll talk about the battle space. What are we doing there? Well, I'm going to refine it a little bit more. I'm going to call it the airborne battle space, okay? And the airborne battle space, with respect to that, we are going to engage ourselves in aerial combat. Okay, we're going to prepare ourselves, and when we enter the battle space, we're going to be up against what is understood to be, right now, understood to be a near-peer adversary, and so we are going to engage a near-peer adversary in aerial combat. And now you've heard me talk about this before, and I guess I'll do it again many times. But when we are preparing for or in actual combat against a near-peer adversary, we are talking about the high end of the conflict spectrum. Okay. So we are going back to focusing on the high end of the conflict spectrum. Now, we had been doing that during the Cold War. We left the high end of the conflict spectrum somewhere, and this is roughly now, but I would say roughly somewhere in the mid to late 1980s. It's possible it was not until the early 1900s that we left or we suspended our focus on the high end of the conflict spectrum. I'm not exactly sure that there's a couple of dates that could be close enough. I was still involved in military operations during that period of time, and so probably it was, from my perspective, it was going to be somewhere in the late 1980s when we left or we suspended our focus on the high end of the conflict spectrum. Now, we have just returned, okay? All right, so you can say that we are making an announcement, and we could, yeah, okay, we are announcing that with respect to our military operations, with respect to the Navy and the Air Force and the Marine Corps and the Army, in particular the Navy and the Air Force, and in very specifically naval aviation, in which I was involved with for a long period of time. Naval aviation has returned to focusing on the high end of the conflict spectrum. How do I know that? Well, because I just returned from a visit to the Naval Aviation Warfare Development Center. We visited that facility as part of the Tailhook Association's annual gathering or annual reunion. Okay, so I can tell you, getting it right from the horse's mouth, that we have returned to focusing on preparing for battle at the high end of the conflict spectrum. Okay. So, our airborne battle space will contain airborne adversaries that are highly capable, that are professionally trained, that are effective, and that are lethal. So, we basically have to be on our A game, okay? We have to be the best. And to be the best and preserve and to win in aerial combat at the high end of the conflict spectrum, we're going to have to do things better than we have ever done before. We're gonna have to be the best that we could possibly be. And how do we do that? Well, we have to focus on two things, okay? Now, all of you that listen to Throttle Up know that my focus is in the area of critical thinking and complex problem solving, okay? If you had to use one term just to make it simple, the term I like to use to describe the Throttle Up Radio Show and podcast is critical thinking, okay? We have to be good at it. We have to be really good at it. We have to be better at it than our adversaries. How do we get there? Well, we focus on it, and we train, and we exercise, and we do all kinds of things to make us the best there is, okay? If we want to be the world's best fighter pilots, if we want to be the world's best air combat specialists, then we have to be able to think critically and solve complex problems in a highly dynamic environment. Okay. I've also used the term large-scale dynamic systems. We are operating, actually, when we're talking about the airborne battle space, the friendly forces are operating large-scale dynamic systems. What are they? Well, you know, the list goes on and on, okay? But if you're looking at the battle space, you're looking at a number of aerial platforms that are specialized in certain parts of the conflict spectrum, and it's operating in a cooperative way. And so it's functioning as a combat system or a large-scale dynamic system that is lethal. We can say it that way. Okay. Nevertheless, we're dealing with large-scale dynamic systems, and we're dealing with complexity, uncertainty, and compression. Okay. Now, yes, I know I used a word there that is not well understood. So let me go back a little bit and explain what I just said. Okay. Complexity. First and foremost, the modern airborne battle space, or the battle space that represents the high end of the conflict spectrum, is in fact complex. That is absolutely a given. We have to recognize that. We have to prepare for it. We have to equip ourselves and our systems with that capability to deal with complexity. Everything is complex. What exactly is complex, or what is complexity? Complexity is, in fact, a very well-defined aspect of reality. You can find it in the Santa Fe Institute. They're promoting complexity theory as well as other places. A lot of research facilities and research organizations deal with complexity. Okay, so you have to understand what complexity is all about and what are the challenges related to things that are complex. And the first and foremost is this. A complex system will behave counterintuitively. That is, the plausible tends to be wrong. Okay, why is that? Because complex things are hard to understand because of all of the interacting variables that are going on. Okay, so in a complex system, there are a lot of players, and there are a lot of things going on, and there are a lot of things that are interacting with one another. Okay, so there you go. Also, uncertainty. Now, with complexity comes uncertainty, but uncertainty could exist by itself as well. What does that mean? Well, we're not certain. We're not certain where the enemy is. The enemy is smart. The enemy is clever. The enemy is deceptive. The enemy may or may not be where we think the enemy is. All kinds of things are uncertain. So in warfare, uncertainty will prevail. That is a given. Okay? And so we have to be able to deal with it. We don't ignore it. We don't pretend it doesn't exist. We deal with it in a coherent and a meaningful way. And we have mechanisms in place that allow us to deal with complexity. There is such a thing as the mathematics of uncertainty and complexity. There is such a thing as that. We employ some of that as well. Okay, so we have complexity, we have uncertainty, and then we have compression. What exactly does that mean? That's short for time compression. What in the world is time compression? Now, we've talked about that on this show before and in other places as well. Time compression occurs about the same time that atmospheric compression occurs. What is going on? Well, it all has to do with velocity. Okay? Think of it. All right, so the airborne battle space, you're traveling through time and space. You are, okay? You're on a velocity vector. everyone, excuse me, everyone in the airborne battle space is actually traveling on or on a velocity vector. Okay, so velocity at a certain velocity, atmospheric compression will occur, and that happens to be the sound barrier, okay? Or another way of saying that, which is the same thing, is that that's where the shock wave occurs. Why is there a shock wave? There's a shock wave because the air around the object, or the air around the vehicle, the vehicle is traveling at a very high velocity. The air around the vehicle is being compressed, and that compression is causing the shock wave. Okay, that's the sound barrier. That's the supersonic shock wave. In that vicinity in which air compresses to cause a shock wave, the time compression occurs as well. And what does that mean? It means that, okay, it actually doesn't mean that your watch or your clock slows down, but the effect is real. What is the effect? The effect is that because you're traveling at such a high velocity, the amount of time available to do anything is shortened or limited or compressed. Okay? So let me say that again because it's pretty important. Okay. At a certain velocity, and it happens to be in the vicinity in which air compression occurs, or in the vicinity in which the shock wave will form on an airplane, and in the vicinity that the sonic boom will manifest itself, in that vicinity, time compression occurs as well, which means that the time available to do anything is shortened or compressed. What does that mean? It means that there has to be something in place to effectively deal with compressed time. And we talked about that before. That's not going to be the subject of this radio show and podcast, but I do want to bring that out because that is a serious challenge that we all faced during the early supersonic era. Did we solve it? Well, we came up with some solutions. Okay, was it completely solved? The answer is no. It wasn't. Not that I can tell. It wasn't completely solved. It was helped along the way. All right, we helped reduce the impact of time compression, where it wasn't quite as dangerous or disruptive to the operation, but we didn't eliminate it entirely. There probably needs to be additional efforts underway to deal with it in an effective way. Okay, so time compression or compression. So we have three things that are going on right now. We have complexity, uncertainty, and compression. Okay, so we enter the airborne battle space, okay, because right now we're talking about military operations, but it could be the problem space if it's a commercial operation. Okay, but we enter, in this case, we're entering the airborne battle space. Now you could say, well, Kevin, you know, in the commercial operation, you know, there's never going to be any kind of thing like the airborne battle space. There's never going to be any kind of thing like, you know, high velocity travel and so forth and so on. And I would say to you, well, then you're not staying up to what's going on in the world today. All right, there is a great deal of talk and a great deal of money going into supersonic travel. Okay, big time. There's lots of money, lots of organizations, lots of military contracts, lots of government contracts, lots of commercial enterprises funding, doing self-funding as well. There's a lot of things going on in terms of velocity. Okay, a lot. We want much higher velocity travel across the globe. We want that. Okay, can we get it? Yes. Why haven't we done it? Many reasons. It's now time to revisit high velocity commercial operations. Also, high velocity military support operations. It's time for us to go back there and look at it. Okay, so if in fact we are dealing with higher levels of velocity, both militarily and commercially, then what does that mean? That means that we have to address ourselves to the problems that are associated with time compression. That's what it means. Okay. Well, then we can have the machine or the AI system handle it, and all of that stuff is just kind of silly. Okay, let's not stop our thinking and wish that we had some kind of a magic wand that we could wave over this thing. It's going to take us quite a bit of effort to be able to effectively deal with time compression and still achieve mission success. And it will, okay? And that's one of the points of this radio show and podcast, is to reveal that reality to the world and to the aerospace industry in particular. We're going to have to deal with increased time compression, and we better get to it right now, okay? And let's not wait until we have a low Earth orbit commercial transportation system that travels somewhere between Mach 2 and Mach 5 to get us across the Pacific in 3 hours or less. Let's not wait until that happens to address ourselves to the problems of time compression. And let's start working on the time compression challenge right now. And that's one of the things that I have brought to the table, one of the things that I'm dealing with in the work that I do, and especially with some organizations that are becoming aware of the problem. So we're looking at it also, I'm looking at it not only individually, but organizationally. So let's start addressing ourselves to that problem. All right. So what is the problem? Well, the problem is this. All right. We just don't enter the airborne battle space or the commercial problem space equipped with the same kind of intellectual capabilities that we had when we were at rest. Okay. That's not going to work. What do we need? Well, we need a lot of things, all right? So the list of technology, of course, is long. The list of human attributes is long. The list of training and experience and capabilities and performance is long. The list of what we call terminal proficiency objectives for the human-machine system. What is the terminal proficiency objectives for this particular area of operation? And those can be defined. I have done so for commercial and military operations, so I know how to do that. Okay, and so, yeah, the list is long. First and foremost, and this is the thing that's often missed, okay? And so I'm just going to come out and say it, all right? We make a big mistake. What is the mistake? The biggest, I think, that one of the biggest mistakes we make, possibly the biggest mistake we have ever made, is we enter the airborne battle space or we enter the commercial problem space without an entry protocol. We don't even know what it is. We don't know how to create one. And so we go in there unarmed. Okay, we just enter without the proper intellectual equipment. That's what we do. Why do we do that? Without the proper intellectual equipment, without the proper global plan or overarching plan, or a better way of saying that, without an entry protocol. So we enter the airborne battle space or the problem space. We enter the airborne battle space without an entry protocol. And guess what happens? Often disaster is the consequence. All right, I can refine that a little bit better. I can say chaos and catastrophe will occur. Okay, let me give you an example. Now, all of you have seen, I'm assuming, all of you have seen the Top Gun Maverick movie. Okay, good. Now, when Maverick was out there doing what it's called, basic flight maneuvers, or what it's called, dogfighting. Okay, you recall he said, "Good morning, aviators. This is your captain speaking. Today's exercise is basic flight maneuvers or dogfighting." All right, what did he do? All right, so he entered the airborne battle space, or in this case, it was a simulated battle space. It was a military operating area, and it was a close replication to what an actual battle space could be. Okay, so we would call it the airborne training exercise space. Okay, we can call it that. All right, and Maverick entered it with by employing a particular maneuver. Okay, so and it caught everybody by surprise. There was the term for the maneuver. We call it the knife edge maneuver, but it was a particular maneuver that Maverick employed. Personally, I don't like that particular kind of maneuver anyway. I thought it was kind of a tricky maneuver, but it had a lot of downside to it. And I never stressed that when I was taking new pilots out to engage in the art and science of air combat. Nevertheless, Maverick uses that, and apparently everybody else was left flat-footed. Okay, why is that? It's because they didn't have an entry protocol. Okay. And that's one of the missing ingredients. It's one of the things that I began to work on quite some time ago, is to come up with a coherent and effective entry protocol. What exactly is the entry protocol? Entry protocol is something that you consider, okay? Something that you consider before you enter the airborne battle space, just before or as you are crossing the boundary that separates the battle space from the non-battle space, okay? What is it? And this is the big question that everyone should ask themselves, is as I am entering the battle space or the problem space, do I have an entry protocol that that I am aware of that I can employ once I detect the enemy forces? If your answer is no, then in my judgment, the best thing is to exit and go back and then develop an entry protocol and then come back and fight another day. Okay. What does your entry protocol consider? Okay, if we're dealing with the airborne battle space, I think that the most important consideration is energy and energy management. That's the most important consideration, bar none. Okay, so do you want to enter the airborne battle space at a lower altitude than the enemy forces, at a co-altitude with the enemy forces, or at a higher altitude than the enemy forces? And the answer is almost certainly you want to be at a higher altitude than the enemy forces. Okay. That's one of the reasons why the P-51 Mustang was so successful in the European theater during World War II, is that it was better at higher altitudes. Okay, it was better when it was higher. Okay, it was just better. Why was that? Well, one, it had a better engine than the enemy aircraft. It had a two-stage supercharger. The enemy did not. And it had better gasoline than the enemy had. So it had three things going for it. It could enter the airborne battle space at a much higher altitude, and that gave it a distinct tactical advantage. Okay, what else is out there? Okay, what else? During the Vietnam conflict, the F-8 Crusader, which was a Navy fighter at the time, very successful, by the way, airplane that I flew as well, the F-8 Crusader could go higher, faster than most other enemy aircraft. Okay. It was better higher. Why is that? Well, it had a better wing. It had a better engine. It could go higher. And it could go higher, faster. Okay. So higher, faster is the other key to mission success. Okay. The other thing, all right, so we talked about fast, we talked about velocity, we talked about energy, which means to get higher, which gives you a better potential energy, and keep your speed up. Okay, you got to keep your speed up. So you got to enter the airborne battle space at a pretty high velocity. Right. One of the things that we learned of in my recent visit to the Naval Aviation Warfare Development Center is this. If the enemy is capable of entering the airborne battle space at speeds that are at or above Mach 1.5, that means 1.5 times the speed of sound, all right, Mach 1 being the speed of sound, okay, Mach 2 being 2 times the speed of sound, Mach 1.5 means 150% times the speed of sound, or 1.5 times the speed of sound, that's what Mach 1.5 means. If the airborne enemy fighter or forces is capable of speeds that could achieve Mach 1.5, it throws a whole new picture on the airborne battle space. So energy, velocity and energy. And last but not least is lethality. So we have three things. We have velocity, we have energy, and we have lethality. What exactly does the entry protocol consist of? Okay, the entry protocol, I'm going to give you a really quick tutorial on it right now, but I only got a couple of minutes, and I want to play something before we end this show. The entry protocol considers the following things. It considers the target aspect angle, and it considers the antenna train angle. These are very, very difficult things to explain. But if you want to learn about it, there is a video out there. And what YouTube channel is that a video on? I'm asking my audio engineer. Is that on the Critical Decision Making YouTube channel? You don't know? No. See, I don't. I'm not sure. Well, I'll have to figure that out and tell them next week. Yeah, because I can't remember. We got a bunch of channels out there. It's a little bit complicated. All right. So the video that explains all of this is available. Okay, there is a video out there. Can they find it through throttleupradio.com? I think they could. Doesn't that link to Sonic Warrior? Or is it the other way around? So you could go to sonicwarrior.com, right? And then that links to Throttle Up. Okay, well, we'll get it out there. It should be up on throttleupradio.com soon, okay? So we'll say it that way. Okay, what are we going to do? Now, we're going to close the show with an audio file, right? And it's called Multi-Domain Battle Space. This is the short version of it, the description of the multi-domain battle space. And this is kind of fun, all right? So let's listen to this. What exactly is a battle space, and what does it mean, and how do you deal with it, and what are the players, and what are the things that have to be considered? You begin to see the level of complexity about modern battle space. And the complexity is beyond belief, by the way. And so we have to have really, really good thinkers, critical thinkers on our side in order to deal with it effectively. All right, so here goes.
3 decades ago, the U.S. Army developed the air-land battle concept, which emphasized securing or retaining the initiative and exercising it aggressively to accomplish the mission. Operations would throw the enemy off balance with a powerful blow from an unexpected direction, follow up rapidly to prevent his recovery, and continue operations aggressively to achieve the higher commander's goals. Airland battle, with its emphasis on initiative, agility, depth, and synchronization, enabled military superiority in subsequent decades. Despite its success, airland battle doctrine had its limitations. It focused on only two domains and predictable patterns of enemy and friendly operations. Today's adversaries have studied airland battle and adapted to develop capabilities that can test joint force operations on land, at sea, in air, space, and the cyber electromagnetic domains. Future Army forces will be prepared to fight and win consistent with the concept of multi-domain battle. Operations that create temporary windows of superiority across multiple domains that enable joint force freedom of action in order to seize, retain, and exploit the initiative. Future enemies will implement aggressive anti-access and area denial, or A2AD, strategies to challenge U.S. air and sea dominance and contest U.S. access to space, cyberspace, and the ability to use the electromagnetic spectrum. Adversaries preparing for combat operations against the U.S. have developed a broad range of cross-domain capabilities. To execute multi-domain operations, U.S. forces must achieve and maintain situational understanding of both enemy and friendly capabilities. Joint force commanders rely on land forces to develop understanding by integrating intelligence and operations in close contact with enemy and populations. These actions are ongoing and can occur over a period of hours, days, weeks, or months. To gain situational understanding, Special Operation Forces, or SOF teams, use networks developed through sustained engagement to gather intelligence, mature situational understanding, and disrupt enemy operations in depth. Army reconnaissance and security formations conduct reconnaissance in all domains and protect assets that are critical to reinforcing defenses or striking enemies in depth. Land forces partner with police and internal security forces to share intelligence and to disrupt enemy SOF teams and collection assets operating in the friendly security zone. Friendly forces conduct deception operations to deny the enemy situational understanding. Combined arms maneuver forces protect cross-domain fires formations and preserve the joint force commander's ability to introduce additional forces. Effective reconnaissance and security operations enable, across domains, the joint force commander to identify enemy critical and vulnerable assets while denying the same information to the enemy. The attack begins with a pre-planned cyber-electromagnetic attack on the enemy to temporarily degrade his network. Near simultaneously, artillery units attack a low-altitude air defense unit to create a gap in the enemy's air defense network. Airstrikes exploit this gap and attack air defense and SSM units to prolong the duration of this window. Army airborne and air assault brigades employing future vertical lift seize key terrain to block approaches to a potential U.S. Marine Corps landing site and threaten enemy lines of communication and air defense sites. With the enemy's surface-to-surface missile batteries and their sensors destroyed or suppressed, a Marine Expeditionary Unit initiates movement while an Army armored brigade envelops and destroys the enemy in defensive positions. Because the enemy will detect and attempt to close the windows that friendly forces open, land-based fires preserve opportunities for joint force maneuver, attacking enemy sensors, aircraft, and artillery batteries through a combination of kinetic and non-kinetic cross-domain fires. An important assumption of multi-domain battle is that the competition for domain superiority will be continuous. In this case, enemy countermeasures result in most of the enemy's air defense and rocket artillery networks being re-established within hours of the initial strike. However, U.S. forces can bypass some of the enemy's counteractions by employing mission orders and launching communications balloons to establish temporary communications networks over critical areas. Simultaneously, other formations with organic, direct, and indirect fires attack enemy units, impeding their maneuver. A naval surface task force attacks enemy surface-to-surface missiles, search radars, and suppresses enemy fires with Army land-based cross-domain fires. Finally, the airborne and air assault brigades, possessing the organic protection, mobility, and lethality across all domains to endure the effects of enemy counterattacks, continue to threaten the enemy rear area. Operating across multiple domains is not a new role for the U.S. Army, Marine Corps, or Special Operating Forces. What is new is the lethality of the battlefield and the conclusion that all domains are contested. These conditions require ready land forces capable of operating in sufficient scale and ample duration to defeat enemies, secure terrain, and project power outward from land to ensure joint force freedom of action. Enabling Army forces in the conduct of multi-domain battle requires advanced capabilities to provide soldiers and units with improved lethality, mobility, and protection. The foundation of the Army's strength has always been and will remain soldiers and teams that possess the capabilities and confidence to overmatch the enemy and win in land combat. Future soldiers, empowered with the capabilities to conduct multi-domain battle, will provide our nation's leadership with multiple options to deter conflict, protect the nation, and win wars.
Okay, now I want to close on this note. Now, and one of the reasons why I wanted to play this is because I wanted to give you all of us a sense of the complexity of what we're dealing with. Okay, so the modern battle space, the modern airborne battle space is very, very complex, particularly against a near-peer adversary operating at the high end of the conflict spectrum. And that's what this audio clip is all about. What does it mean to operate at the high end of the conflict spectrum? Number one, things are going to happen very, very quickly. Repositioning, adapting, the need for agility and mobility and all of that stuff is paramount. And what else is implied? And this is something that I'm going to run by my audio engineer as well. I think what else is implied is the fact that we have got to have really good thinkers on the battlefield and not wait for orders from headquarters. What do you think? Don't you think that that's pretty well a given? We have to be able to take the initiative with our combat forces. Our combat forces need to be empowered to take the initiative and not wait for orders. Okay, so, and my audio engineer agrees with me, and that if we have learned anything about anything on this show is that we have to be able to take the initiative quickly. And that means that we have to have trained critical thinkers and trained complex problem solvers on the battlefield, engaging the enemy in the best way that we can. And that's the way we're going to win. We're going to win because we can outthink the enemy. We can outperform the enemy because we can respond to whatever the enemy is doing in a very quick and effective way. How much time do I have? Are we at the end of another radio show? Okay, we're at the end of another radio show and podcast. Thank you for listening. We will see you all next week.